Hello and welcome everyone back to another episode of The Publisher Lab. I am Tyler Bishop, joined with me today, kind of a solo episode if you would, but I'm not solo here and neither are you there listening wherever you are in your car, home, gym. I'm not going to put on you where you have to listen to a podcast. So wherever you are is my producer Manny, joined with me today.
Hey, good to be back, everybody.
Hopefully everybody enjoyed last week's episode. If you didn't have a chance to give it a listen, go back and especially if you're interested in SEO, we had Zach on, and we'll likely have him on again. We talked a lot about SEO. It's his area of expertise, and I think, you know, if you're navigating sort of like the modern world of SEO, I think, you know, SEO is something that's always changing, but it's always changed within these certain sort of like parameters or walls, if you will. And I think in the next decade, we're going to see probably an SEO that looks quite a bit different than the one we have now. And probably, you know, SEO isn't even probably the right term for it. And that's something that we explore and how you navigate that to, from, you know, now and still kind of look towards the future. So I'd give it a listen. You can find our past episodes and sort of navigate to watch the video if you haven't ever, you know, watched the podcast, or even just leave us questions and give us feedback. We'd love it at publisherlab.org. With that out of the way, we'll hop into some of the news and just some of the trends that are going on out there. We have very similar topics each week, but there's always some kind of, there's something new, and hopefully we can balance between practical and a utility base to the content that you guys listen to on the show. And then also just keeping you informed, because I think one of the things about publishing is that if you are listening to the show, it means you care about sort of where things are shifting, where things are moving in our space. And I would say that's the most important step towards future-proofing your business in the world of publishing, in my experience. And so getting into the world of publishing and talking about, I mean, who else but Google? Google search, their antitrust trial continued last week and is continuing into this week. Producer Manny, walk us through a little bit about what's happened since maybe last time we kind of got into this topic, or give us a little bit of a summary of where things are at now.
So we're a few weeks into the Google antitrust trial, and the U.S. Justice Department is challenging Google's tactics to maintain its search engine dominance. The DOJ alleges that Google paid a hefty sums to companies like Apple to ensure its default search engine status. Key figures, including Google's CEO, are testifying, and the trial is expected to last about 10 weeks. And they're saying that this could reshape the entire search engine landscape. A verdict is anticipated early next year, but Google's defense emphasizes that it's a superior product, while that it's the superior product that's the reason that they are so dominant in the space.
I saw this, and I think we're going to get into it. Do we have it later on, or is it this story where they included the quotes from the Google exec that had apparently his comments were the judge allowed them to be revealed, but they were definitely not things that he wanted out in public, and he claims were part of a presentation that were meant to be hyperbolic and not true.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a little bit later on. Is that related to the exec emails?
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it's hard to separate those two in some regards, because one of the things that you can look at with this, and this is news that is not new, but it's new in the context of this case. So we've known since, I think it's like 2003 or 2004, and we now know this, that Google paid Apple well ahead of when the smartphone became the smartphone. They were very forward-thinking in that regard. I think one of the things you can look at with this trial with Google is, especially over the last two decades, fairly few have been as innovative and forward-looking and accurate as Google. So they were able to identify that the smartphone sort of like search wave was coming, and they got exclusivity with Apple to be the default search engine. And I think originally they paid them $4 billion for that luxury. But we've seen here recently, now it's up to $19 billion. So whatever the escalator is in that contract or that agreement, is significant. And, you know, the thing about this is that that relationship, you know, Google and Apple might claim that it's because Google offers a superior product. But, you know, I think that's a big part of this trial. It's like, I wonder how you would prove that, because at best, I would imagine that you can only do so on the grounds of user preference. And maybe that goes a long way, and maybe that's the criteria that Apple had selected. But boy, I got to tell you, you know, Microsoft, I think, has got something to say about that. And you can make the argument that, you know, prior to the smartphone revolution, Microsoft carried equal weight in terms of reliability, credibility, and preference for people. And you can't just use sort of like where things are at now to make that determination of, you know, user preference on Google versus another search engine, because we have that preference largely because of the experiences that we've had because of something like this. And that's exactly what antitrust is supposed to explore. So it's interesting. $19 billion, producer Manny. I mean, to Apple, I know that that's not, you know, they're not going to cry over it, but, you know, I could probably figure something out to do with that.
Oh, absolutely. And what shocks me even more is that Microsoft offered them even more money to have Bing be the default browser, but still, like, just the strong arm that Google gave Apple, and they ultimately just went with Chrome as the default browser. And it does show here that they were questioning, or better yet, they were questioning Eddie Q, Apple's senior vice president of services, and asked them if Apple would be wanting, or if they had any intentions of creating a search engine that would compete against Google's Chrome. And they said Apple has no intentions of building a search engine to challenge Google. The United States Justice Department has scrutinized Google's multi-billion dollar deal with Apple, which sees Google paying Apple around $10 billion annually to be the default search engine. But then they also get a cut of the ad revenues, which is why it adds up to $19 billion.
Yeah.
So it's just, it's interesting to see, you know, Google continuing to be questioned on these things, and it's not looking good.
Yeah. And so if you're a publisher out there and, you know, you have concerns about, you know, like, you know, the advertising ecosystem and the value and the survivability of advertising, well, it survived more so than any other form of revenue stream for publishers for the last, I mean, really millennia, if you want to get into it. But this is a great example of it, because I wonder what that percentage of revenue share is on that, you know, ad revenue, because now you've got two of the largest and most significant parties in digital publishing that are essentially colluding on the idea that, you know, like, incentivized to, you know, show more ads. And I think that that's a good thing for a healthy model for revenue for publishers. But I also think it's unhealthy too, because I think it's, you know, if you've listened to this podcast before, I've talked a lot about ad inflation, and it's directly the result of the platforms. And I think that this is something that definitely doesn't help that. And, you know, this is kind of like where we get into a little bit about, you know, these Google executive emails as well. And I mentioned it kind of like as we were starting out on the story regarding Google, but here recently, they actually wanted these emails sort of not unsealed, is what they call it in the courtroom. And they became unsealed, and then Google appealed that and didn't want them unsealed. And then the judge actually ended up unsealing both the emails and unsealed sort of like the petition to not reveal it, which makes Google, I think, look a little bit worse in the scenario, because it's obvious that they don't want that out there, because for good reason. Producer Manny, do you have some details you can share with us on that? I can't remember the exact quotes, but I can dig them out if I need to.
I'll pull up here the quotes here in a second, just to give like a quick overview. The ongoing U.S. antitrust trial against Google has unveiled emails among Google executives discussing strategies to amplify ad revenues. These emails stemmed from 2017 to 2019 and involved top figures, including Ben Gomez from Google Search's algorithm team. This discovery challenges Google's claim of a separation between its advertising and an organic search team. The emails could influence the outcome of the entire trial.
And so there's always been these things that have been alleged, and Google has very specifically shot these down in the past. And I think that's an area where, you know, if you try to say, well, technically we said this, and Google's very good about that. I think that they've addressed this enough to where I think that there'll you'll be able to say, look, it's very disingenuous or misleading when asked directly, you know, if you buy ads, will that help your organic search ranking because, you know, you're getting more click-throughs from the SERP or something like that, which used to be like an alleged, you know, sort of thing and a, you know, common SEO strategy that you don't see as much anymore. But one of the things that sticks out to me in it is that, you know, they are essentially managing and manipulating supply and demand. And that's one of the things that antitrust is supposed to guard against, because you don't want somebody to be able to become dominant in a space where they have the ability to manipulate the supply and demand, because then you can essentially, you know, you can create this business that's unapproachable because you're manipulating the market. And in doing so, you find with Google, one of the things that in these executive emails, one was a presentation that he was supposed to give for a university. And apparently he never gave it, but it was in these like, you know, these emails that they had to turn over to the Justice Department. And in one of them, the executive compared Google products, specifically search and advertising, as a rare business model comparable only to firearms and drugs. And that they could essentially control the supply and demand. It's a great business. They can manipulate things so that whenever there was the supply was short, you know, they could shorten the supply whenever demand was short, and they could, you know, artificially inflate the supply whenever the demand was low and all this kind of stuff. And I think that one of the things that is very telling about this is that both Google and the executive released kind of very different statements. Google said, we don't endorse that, and we don't believe that, and we don't recognize it. And, you know, this was meant for a presentation that was supposed to be hyperbolic and untrue, is essentially what they said, which it's like, all right, sure, I guess that those statements that they made that ring true to just about anybody that's heard them and are factually and materially based on like real data, those things I'm sure were meant to be false. But yeah, it stands out to me. I don't know, producer Manny, again, maybe I'm just being too cynical. Do you buy it? Do you believe that this was for a presentation in which they were supposed to just make a bunch of stuff up?
No, I mean, I understand the concept of marketing math where you maybe like exaggerate or better yet, just kind of cherry pick certain numbers. But in something like this, especially when they're like finding a connection between the ad department and the algorithm department, just it's not a good look. It's not a good look. It's just continuing to stack the deck against Google in this antitrust trial.
Yeah. And it disrupts your trust. If you put all your money into a bank, and, you know, it was in a, you know, a fixed income, you know, like some type of financial product or whatever, you're earning, you know, some percentage. And you found out that actually the bank was colluding with the Treasury, and, you know, what they were paying you percentage wise, you could be making way more because of the, you know, the value of the dollar bond or whatever it is, has actually been going up that entire period of time. But they colluded to keep it at 4%. And you actually were the one that got hurt by that because the markets actually should have, you know, maybe had a higher interest rate or something like that you earned on it. You'd be kind of upset about that. And this is really similar to that. It's almost no different. And I think that's what the Justice Department will argue. And it'll be interesting to see if there's enough of a smoking gun there to actually lay out something that, you know, has some real teeth to it. And speaking of something with some real teeth to it, AI, we're going to get into it again today. And I think one of the things that, was, you know, kind of fast approaching early on was how was AI going to, duplicate or supplant some of the many search functions and features of a search engine? And like, where would that fall in terms of user behavior? And Bing seemed to be leading the charge in that. But at right sort of as it was building momentum, OpenAI pulled back the sort of search with Bing functionality inside of its tool set. And now it's back, right, Producer Manny? Is Bing back now?
So that search functionality within OpenAI is back. So I don't know if anyone noticed that back in March or before March, you were able to just input a URL into ChatGPT, and then it itself would then scour through the data on that web page and then give you back any information you were looking for. That stopped working. So they recently brought that back on September 27th, and they reintroduced this feature to allow users to access current and authoritative information. Initially launched back in May, excuse me, not March, the feature was temporarily disabled, and they were saying to make room for improvements, but it seems like it's just going back to that. And I feel like there's a lot of distrust amongst publishers who are just concerned about ChatGPT going in and then just basically taking all of their information and data from their page.
Well, I think that you're right. I think that there is some concern there, and for good reason. You know, publishers have a very difficult time trusting anything called a search engine. And that's revealed in another story we've got up today. It shows that 26% of the top 100 publishers are actually blocking GPT bot. And I find that very interesting. So can you tell me a little bit more about this, Producer Manny? I know you had a chance to look into it a little bit.
Yeah, so this list of publishers, it's 26% of the top 100 websites. It was 242 of the top 1,000 websites.
Okay.
So it's not just like a small percentage of the internet. And these websites include websites like Pinterest, Indeed, The Guardian, Science Direct, USA Today, WebMD, Dictionary.com, The Washington Post, NPR, CBS News, and so on and so forth. So it's a lot of notable companies who are saying, no, we're not going to allow the ChatGPT bot to kind of scour our information. And just kind of, you know, unveiling the curtain here. So occasionally, whenever we get like show notes and just very like hyper focused on small information, usually just throw that information in ChatGPT. If you throw anything from all these websites, ChatGPT comes back with an error message. So you can't even choose to like, hey, look for this information. And even if it's just like copied and paste, it won't give you the information.
Very interesting. I didn't know that. I think one of the things that sticks out to me about some of these sites, though, that may give both a disproportionate idea of sort of like the value, because if you're listening to this podcast and you're thinking, I need to block GPT bot on my website, number one, I would say probably don't. And number two, I'd say don't waste your time. Because there's another story in DigiDay this week that goes over something that if you've listened to this podcast before, I've talked about, but you know, web crawlers, just because you block a crawler from your site, you essentially would have to stop visitors from coming or requiring them to like log in confirm or authorize their identity somehow to actually truly stop a crawler from getting your being able to crawl your site, because a crawler and a bot can perform identical behaviors as a user. I mean, when you're looking at analytics inside of something like Google Analytics, you're looking at user agent data. So user agent is just like a browser and, you know, something that's piloting it. And whether that's a person or a bot, you know, you don't really get to know. However, if you block that bot, you're also blocking a user. And if you tell it to not follow it or not crawl it or something like that, it might not on purpose. It might not on purpose. And so I think that is one thing to kind of keep in mind with this, is there's very little and to do about that. I will say this is that many of the publishers mentioned that were blocking it, it's kind of like they don't want to get scooped, because a lot of it is modern information. So if the Washington Post reports on, you know, breaking news, they immediately could be scooped by AI, which maybe doesn't give the sort of like same credentials to, you know, the journalist or the original publication that got the story right. There's an etiquette in journalism that maybe doesn't get followed. Even if you can apply that, like, to what degree, you know, can you gather information from multiple sources and then report on it? Just, I think it makes a lot of sense for those publications to sort of like bring that in house as opposed to letting some third party sort of curate a lot of the journalism that's out there. So that makes sense. But with evergreen content or, you know, authoritarian or expert content, which I would say is the majority of publishers that are out there, I don't know that it makes the same amount of sense. But I do find it interesting because I know that Google has been talking more and more about this. And it's one of the big reasons why a lot of companies have stopped using generative AI. And it's because if ChatGPT crawls the web and gathers information, and, you know, like it was allowed to crawl it or whatever, but that information is proprietary. And then maybe it's about development and I started a new company and I write some software and start selling it. But somewhere in my software, you know, I let ChatGPT write something that it learned from, you know, maybe some code that's already has some intellectual property tied to it somewhere else. And because of that, technically under the laws that exist today, you know, I would then owe money to the originator of this intellectual property because I used ChatGPT. And I think that Google is sort of recognizing this threat as well, and they're letting publishers opt out of training data. And I know that that's a story that that came from Adweek this week, right, Producer Manny?
Yes, it did. So Google unveiled Google Extended, which is a tool that's allowing publishers to opt out of their data being used for AI training. And one of the big debates that they were having, because it sparked a little bit of controversy, that you have to actually go in and opt out as opposed to choosing to allow your data and information to, you know, be a part of the AI's training. So that's just, you know, it seems like Google is like, yeah, sure, here you can kind of protect your information and all of your data, but you have to choose to not give it to us.
Yeah, it's the same thing that, I mean, Google has applied this to everything they want people to do, and it's pretty effective. So if you think that, you know, a lot of publishers are going to go and do this, they're not going to, because Google Ads, I know when ads.txt became a thing and stuff like that, at first they were like, you can opt in as an advertiser to only buying, you know, from sites that have an ads.txt file. But then slowly but surely, because they wanted that to happen, they pushed it to where it's the default. So most advertisers and most agencies are not going in and selecting that they want to buy from sites without an ads.txt file. So the inventory and the number of bidders is just a lot less. And so it became, you know, a priority for publishers to make sure that they had that. Otherwise, they just wouldn't earn anywhere near the same amount of money because so many advertisers just weren't bidding on it. And it'll be the same with this, where it's a very small number of publishers will actually go through the trouble to opt out of something that Google is not going to market. But speaking of advertisers, one of the shifts that's been occurring for well over two decades now is a shift from digital ad spending or shift to digital ad spending from traditional media. And for the longest time, I think it was thought of as a nice to have. I can credit many successes in my career to the belief and a culmination of digital eating the lunch money of what we would call today traditional media. And so, Producer Manny, what's the latest on this sort of shift?
So this comes from Adweek.com, and we're seeing the United States ad spending has shown a positive trend with a 4.4 year-over-year gain in the second quarter of 2023. However, while the digital media format like search, commerce, and social media have grown by 8.7%, traditional media formats including TV and radio have declined by 4.1%. And this trend indicates a shift in the advertising preferences, with digital platforms expected to capture 69% of the total ad spend in 2023. And the challenges faced by the linear TV and potential impact of writer strikes could further accelerate the shift to digital. So I think this is a positive trend for digital publishers, because it seems like there's going to be a lot more ad spending this year and moving forward.
I would caution that. Yeah. And the reason is because, so I have a much more granular look at this data, And Statista is a service that I subscribe to and look really closely at a lot of their advertising industry and geo global sort of like perspective on how these things have shifted over time. And while digital continues to grow and it's eating a larger percentage of the pie, one thing I'll preface this with is that advertising spending only goes up, even if it goes down like year over year, because there's like a crisis or something terrible happens, it goes right back up. It's linear. It's more significant correlation than even something like the stock market. As long as there's more people and global GDP continues to grow, advertising revenue grows right along with it. We've yet to see that not occur. But where that pie is split up has shifted significantly over time. I mean, you go back as far as you want, from radio to television. So digital is eating more and more of that pie and will continue to until, you know, if zero innovation occurs over the next 10 years, I'm sure that digital will be the majority of the pie. That said, that digital pie used to be pretty straightforward. Now it's splintering. That what digital is has changed a lot. And even within sort of like the sort of columns that you would sort of identify them in, something like social, influencers, paid platform ads, paid promotions, secondary inventory from those. These things are all sort of like branching out even further. And what you're seeing now with the death of things like third-party cookies and also big shifts in terms of, just user behaviors and stuff like that, is advertisers, because they are content, remember, advertising is not going to spend less money. Advertising is going to spend more. They're at a crossroads now because they have to figure out, where can I effectively spend this money? Because you used to be able to dump it all into Google and let Google figure it out. There's a loss of trust there, despite the fact that the technologies that Google did that on are sort of fading away. So now you have advertisers going, well, where is my audience and how do I find them? And they're looking to go as directly as they possibly can. So again, we talked a lot about on this show about how web publishers need to start thinking a little bit more like social media or YouTube based content creators, not from a personification perspective, but thinking about it in terms of how they market their content and how they build a relationship with an audience. And this is another great reason why, is because there are advertisers out there that want to work with you directly. Almost everyone listening to the show, if you build something of value, I promise you, you will have advertisers that want to work with you directly. But there's going to be mechanisms over the next 5-10 years that are going to be really available to you if you know this and if you continue to make content for your audience. But when you look at, when you back away and just say, well, digital, that should be good for me, I think that that's a little bit of a red herring, because it may not be the digital that you're making money from today. It may be similar, but you may have to be agile enough to adapt. And I would say, like, that's the caution that I would put here, because for the longest time, I think everybody just sort of looked at it as like, digital is going up, that's good, that means more money. Now I think it's a matter of, yeah, it means more money for somebody. Is it going to mean more money for you? Does that make sense, Producer Manny?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I feel like it's something we've been promoting and pushing on this podcast for, you know, almost 40 episodes. You have to adapt. You have to be ready. Change, be, you know, flexible, and know when to make decisions that are going to impact.
Yeah, and realistically, if you're a publisher that's listening to the show, the straightforward advice is to cut out middlemen at every chance that you can, because this ecosystem is filled with them. And it's for a good reason. You're in a good business. There's a lot of money in it. And I think that because of that, you're going to find that there's a lot of opportunity, but there's a lot of opportunists as well. And I think you being able to understand who provides value, and, you know, somebody like Google has provided a lot of value over the last decade. But is that value going to be the same over the next decade? And I would argue, just on, you know, sort of the processes, the legal ones, that they're going through, that it doesn't look like it. It doesn't mean that they're going to go away, but there is a world in which Google isn't providing the same value to you as a publisher as they have been over the last, you know, 20 years or so. So I just think that if you're listening to the show, you're on the right track, because no one can tell you for sure which direction things will go or what innovations will occur. But as long as you are keeping your finger on the pulse of things and listening to shows like the Publisher Lab, hopefully you will continue to be able to adapt and adjust and stay ahead, because I think, those on the forefront are usually the ones that are the most successful. And, you know, your percentage chance of, you know, success and, you know, long-term survivability are, you know, they tear down from there, depending on how quickly you adapt or don't. But I'm very optimistic if you're a publisher today. I do think that in many ways I've said for a long time, we're in the golden age of publishing, and maybe just the dawn of it. And I think if you are concerned about things in the future, I would say uncertainty is always kind of uncomfortable. But at the same time, I also think that there's people listening to the show right now that in 5 to 6 years will be glad that they stayed the course and be able to probably tell us a lot about why they were successful over the last 5 or 6 years. And I'm interested to see what that looks like. And like all of you, I'm in the dark as well. And I'm pretty sure no one can tell us the future of how things will occur. But hopefully you'll be listening to the show and I'll be able to navigate this space with you. And you can drop us a line and ask me a question at publisherlab.org or give us some feedback on the show. And if you have a chance, give us a like or a review on podcast platforms, whichever one you listen to it on. It continues to help us grow the show, and we'd really appreciate it. I know producer Manny'd appreciate it. Hard at work producing the show, helping us get it out there. If you check out our shorts on Twitter or on YouTube, and just, yeah, help us share the news and if you like the show, tell people about it. And that's it. Hopefully we'll catch you next time on another episode of The Publisher Lab.